These roles are easier for Christians when we're walking with the Lord. In the first part of Colossians 3, we've seen that we are to live as those who are raised up with Christ. That means there are certain things we set aside. We don't do those things anymore. Instead, we put on the new man and we walk in a different way. And all those characteristics are things that are going to make us successful in fulfilling our roles within the family as well, and with all society. If I'm living in godliness, I am going to have a greater impact on those around me for good. If I'm living in ungodliness, I'm going to affect them for evil. And certainly with our children, we want to affect them for good. Now, we've gone over all these roles in specific. We also know that for non-Christians and those who are not walking with the Lord as they should, they're still immature for whatever reason, these things are going to be very difficult, but yet they're still commanded. Everybody's responsible for it. Women, those who are wives, you're to be subject to your husbands. It's fitting in the Lord, Colossians 3:18. We did one whole sermon on that. A wife who is wise builds her house. The foolish one will tear it down with her own hands. And so wives need to follow the lead of their husbands. Be the helpmeet that God created you to be and build him up and show him respect that he needs. Okay? That way both will be successful in life. We talked 1 week about husbands. You have a great and awesome responsibility. Colossians 3:19 says, love your wives. Do not be embittered against them. Now, this is that sacrificial love that gives of itself for the best interest of the other person. You cannot be selfish. You can't be turning and looking what you want to get from her. You need to be the one who gives. She should respond in love to you. You also have the additional roles of leading, providing, protecting the family, and God is going to hold you accountable for those things. So fulfill your role. Children, your role is to be obedient. Colossians 3:20, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Paul adds in Ephesians 6, 2, and 3 that this actually is based out of the fifth commandment of the Ten Commandments, to honor your parents. And it's the first commandment with a promise that it may be well with you and that you might live long in the land. Why? Because children who are in rebellion, if they're in rebellion against the parents, they are in rebellion against God as well. And that's not good. Because all the things that characterize that will end up shortening your life. This is for your good. Learn to obey your parents. In addition, when we did that sermon, we saw the fact that obedience is actually the foundation for all other learning skills. Without obedience, you're not going to learn. It takes that. We've also spent 3 sermons already in the role of parents, and I pointed out general principles as well as very specific commands. And I'm probably going to repeat some of those principles and maybe even a couple of specific commands, but this morning I want to deal with the very last part of your active parenting. When your children were very young, your major task was to train them to obey. And if you were efficient with that and diligent with that, by the time they're 5 or 6, and it's going to vary with kids, some do better and some are a little later, they should have first-time obedience. When you tell them to do something, they will do it the first time you tell them, and they will do it right away. They're not going to delay it. You can have that trained into your child. That's your goal. Early childhood, train them to obey. The next section of parenting, pre-adolescence, is training their hearts. Your goal is to instill within them the moral reasoning for why they do anything. You do that by explaining what your rules are, why we do what we do. In fact, I did put some copies in the back of what we used to have posted on our doors, the Harris Family Rules. We had 10 different things. This is what we do, and it stated, and why we do it. The moral reason is crucial, because what you want to train them is to be able to think for themselves why they need to do whatever they need to do. With that, it doesn't matter what the situation is. They can apply the principles themselves. If you were diligent with that, by the time they're 12 or 13, they should largely have transitioned from obeying you out of fear because you're mom and dad into submission because they already understand first obedience is to God always. And they will do what is right because it's right before God, not just because you said it. They want to do what God wants them to do. So that's 12 or 13. That's the second part, training their hearts. Now, the last part of parenting is transitioning them to adulthood, adolescence, the teen years, we often call it. This period of transition, in some ways, can be the most challenging, but it is also the most enjoyable and the most satisfying period of parenting. This should be the fun era of your parenting. You're transferring them to independence, from dependence upon you on everything to independence. Eventually, they should be able to establish their own home, right? That's the goal. Now, I recall when I was young, my parents were perplexed by the complaints that they heard from their peers. These teenagers, they're so terrible, and I'm having such a terrible time with them. Now, I'm the middle of three boys, and when all three of us were in teen years, we had a ball. In fact, my mother to this day will tell you her favorite period of family life was when all three of us were teens. Now, think about that. Three boys living in Los Angeles, and this is her favorite period. Okay? Now, modern conventional wisdom seems to be that teens are going to rebel. In fact, remember when Jonathan was born, I had someone tell me, "Is enjoy him now while he's so young and innocent, because you know in about 13, 14 years, he's going to really tear your heart up. He's going to rebel." I don't think so, because I was going to repeat what had been done with me by my parents. My dad was very grounded in the biblical idea of parenting, because his parents had grounded him in it, and I said, no, I'm looking forward to teen years. I am anxious for the teen years to come. And when we ended up with three boys, I was really anxious. I'm like, well, we can kind of repeat what I had. And I know we had a great time, and all my expectations have been met. The teen years, I will say, have been the most enjoyable part of my parenting. Now, certainly there's challenges in it, different challenges than when they're young, but it has definitely been the most enjoyable. Even from the pragmatic aspect, think about it. They clean themselves. They can earn their own money. They don't have to spend yours. Okay? All those things are pretty good. They can help out with more household chores, too. That's good. All right? So there's some great things about it. Teen rebellion is a phenomenon of modern Western society, and it is there because it has largely abandoned the biblical principles of parenting. That is why it has become common. Before the 1960s, there was some element starting in the 50s, but before the 60s, if you had a rebellious teen, people looked like, what's wrong with you? That's odd. If you go around the world today, you're still going to find teen rebellion is common in most cultures. It's a phenomenon of the Western culture that has rejected biblical principles of parenting. That's why it's now, we think it's supposed to be. It's not. If you are not there yet, I'm telling you now, you should look forward to your children becoming teenagers. Be anxious for it. It is going to be a great time if you parent properly. If you don't, then it is going to be the most miserable time of your life. Okay? You've got to follow the biblical principles. For the rest of this morning, I want to point out some of these biblical principles so that you can make the teen years the best in your family and establish your youths as responsible young adults. Now, I want you to understand first what the Bible says about teenagers, and to do that, you have to look for a different word. You're not going to find teenager in there. That was kind of coined back in the 20th century. Throughout the scriptures, you're going to find the word youth. Now, there's several Hebrew words and one Greek word that are translated that way, and they cover quite an age range. Context always is important. In this case, really important. Context will tell you about how old they're dealing with when it says youth. Let me give you a couple examples. Genesis 37:2 specifically states that Joseph was 17 years old, and it calls him a youth. The word is na'ar. When he was pasturing his pastor's flock, at 17, he's out on his own and he's taking care of the sheep. He is still called a youth, a na'ar, several years later when Pharaoh's cupbearer remembers him as the one who could interpret dreams. So it's got a stretch there quite a ways. King Josiah was a youth, na'ar, of 16 years old when he began to seek God, according to 1 Chronicles 34. However, the same word, na'ar, is also used for Samuel when he's only a few years old. 1 Samuel 1:22. So context is important. Context is always important in your Bible study. Now, at the other extreme, we find that the exact same word is used in reference to young adults who are married, Proverbs 5:18. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. You married her when you were young. And I should point out that in that culture, they married a lot younger than we do. In fact, our age has seemed to keep getting higher and higher and higher. Since 1987, when I last did some statistical stuff on this, the average age then for men was 27 and women was 24. Now it's women is 27 and men are 29. That's the average for first marriages now in America. We've really extended this. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but we'll talk about that some other time. But this brings up the next point about youth in the Bible compared to youth culture in the United States. In our society, there are some extreme assumptions that are made that get put into the parenting practice, and that causes problems. Sometimes these are way too common, and they're contrary to what Scripture itself states. And the first is that this idea that teens are wise enough to make their own decisions without parental involvement. Now, this extreme lets teens do whatever they want with little or no accountability. And it's going to vary with the parent, but we've dealt with parents who've had this mindset, well, they're 14, they can do what they want. They're 16, they can drive a car, they can do what they want. They're 18, they can do whatever they want. Why? They're legally an adult. They may be legally an adult, but doesn't mean they have the mindset of an adult yet. All right? Hopefully you're transitioning them by 18, they'd have it, but they may not. All right? They're still a youth. And there are weaknesses in youth that we need to be aware of. That's why there's continued parenting even when they have gotten older. We need to be careful here. Now, in the case of children who have been trained well in godliness, they may be able to handle a lot of independence, especially as they get to 17 and 18. They probably can do most things on their own. But there are several scriptures that point out a weakness even among them that they need to be careful about and we need to be aware of as parents. One of the purposes of the book of Proverbs, of course, is to give prudence to the naive and the youth knowledge and discretion, Proverbs 1:4. To give to youth, same word, to these who are still young, wisdom, knowledge, discretion, prudence. Even a very intelligent youth lacks the experience of years that are needed to have the knowledge necessary and the discretion that is necessary as an adult. You don't have enough experience yet. You're going to get blindsided by things. It's difficult sometimes to think through all the principles that need to be put into place. And that's why a wise youth is going to seek out counsel from those who are older and have such wisdom. Proverbs has quite a few statements about this. Proverbs 1:8 and 4:1 tells us that that begins with parents. The youth should seek out parental involvement, parental advice. It extends to the others as well. Proverbs 1:5 says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes. The wise man listens to counsel." So you find those who know what they're talking about in that field, and you talk with them and gain that wisdom. Now, the tragedy is that there's a strong tendency, especially in American youth culture, to follow the foolishness of Rehoboam. You may recall him. He was Solomon's son, and he sought two groups of counselors. He sought his father's counselors, who were older and wiser. He didn't like their counsel. He sought the men who were his age. They told him what he wanted to hear, and he used their counsel and split the kingdom. Too often we're the same way. Our youth tend to go to their peers for counsel rather than to those who actually have the years necessary to give the wisdom. All right, so that's for you teens too. Be careful who you're getting your counsel from. Go to those who know it. Now, no teen has gained enough knowledge to make all their own decisions without the counsel of those who are older and wiser. And it's interesting to know that even Luke 2:52, after Jesus was 12 years old, it states that he kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Jesus had to grow too. So what makes you think that I'm 14, I'm 16, I'm 18, I got it all? You don't. There is still growth. And in fact, there will be growth all your life. When your hair is gray, you're still going to be growing. You're still going to need counsel. So parents, be involved with your teens. They need your knowledge. They need your wisdom. Teens, seek out such counsel and guidance. Now, an indicator of the weakness of youth is also found in the very frequent mention of indiscretion on the part of youth. There's quite a few different passages that speak of the sins of my youth, because it's a period of life that's easily swayed away from where you should go. Peer pressure becomes strong. There's not enough experience in walking with God to know exactly what He wants. Your own desires can be overwhelming. You haven't learned how to handle the emotions that are part of life. Not only that, but in those teen years, adolescence, the hormones start flowing, and then you really get wacky in the mind. All right? That's just part of life. So there is a weakness there. Job said, who was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil, Job 1:1. So this is quite a man of great character. In Job 13:26, he also said he remembered the iniquities of his youth. So even a man of that stature, that kind of character, when he was young, had problems. And he fell, he stumbled. David cried out to the Lord in Psalm 25:7 that God would not remember the sins of his youth or his transgressions. Timothy had proven himself already as very faithful as a man of God. He's even called that in 1 Timothy 6:11, but Paul still warned him in 2 Timothy 22:22, flee youthful lusts, youthful desires. Be careful here, Timothy. And that's to a man, he says, you're a man of God. We need to heed that. The tragedy in our own culture is that so many in the entertainment advertising fields are evil and specifically target our teens to entice them towards evil. Now, that means the very adults that should be helping them stand firm against it are doing the opposite. We need to be careful here. For some, they're just after making a quick profit. Others are more sinister. They desire to entrap your teen in a sinful lifestyle that they will then be able to exploit the rest of their life. And all these movies, the music they listen to, the stuff that's available on the computer is all designed to entice them towards a certain way of life. Very little of it is towards godliness. Are we protecting them? Are you making them think through the issues that are involved with that? And as you help them, also help them learn how to deal with the guilt that comes when they do fall. Don't leave them there. Help them work through it. That's what we need to do as adults. We need to help our teens do the same thing. Another weakness that Scripture points out in youth is a lack of proper confidence. Jeremiah freely acknowledges fear of the Lord's commission because he said, I'm a youth, Jeremiah 1:6. I'm not ready for this, God. God said, if I say you're ready, you're ready. But you're going to have to do what I say and send him out. Paul had to encourage Timothy. Why? Because he was timid, he says, as a youth. 1 Timothy 4:12, 1 Corinthians 16:10 even says he feared. Encourage him because he's going to come and he's going to be fearful. Both young men were called to serve the Lord, but it would take experience over the years for them to learn to practically trust God in the situations of life. It takes time to learn those things. Youth need to be encouraged. They also need to be put in situations where they're going to learn to trust the Lord. If everything's handed to them, they're not going to learn to trust. Can you challenge them to take on things where they're going to have to trust God? I'll tell you frankly, David going to Africa 2 years ago was instrumental in his life learning that lesson. He left here as a fearful young man. He gets to the airport and he lost the contact phone number. What do you do if you're 9,000 miles from home and you don't know how to get in touch with the person who's supposed to pick you up? He just said, okay, God. He walked out and the man he needed to meet was standing there. Didn't have a sign, just walked up and said, are you David? From that point on, he said, I think I can trust God. Okay? But he had to be put in a situation he had to trust him. You know what? He had no choice. And he learned. And that's why he's back on out in Africa now. He learned to trust God, to take on the challenge. Are we helping our youth to take on those kinds of risks? That they can trust God. Do what is right. Let him handle the results. Now, there's also the other side of it. There is strength in youth. And I want to put this out there, too, because it battles a different problem that is rampant in our society. There is this high, thick wall of protection that's built up around our youth that prevents them from making decisions themselves and from learning to trust God. And so they continue in perpetual childhood, and they never learn to take on the adult responsibilities, or it's very delayed. That is one reason why marriage is delayed so long. We've got these folks in their mid-20s, and they're children. That's how they act. That's how they're still living. They're children. They've not yet taken on the responsibilities of an adult. Consider some of the things in Scripture that are recorded that were done by various quote-unquote youths. This is incredible. Our teens can do a whole lot more than most of us think they can do. They're actually very capable. Joseph, I already pointed him out earlier, he was 17 when he was sold into slavery in Egypt. Yet his character was such that his master developed such trust in him and his abilities, it wasn't long that Joseph was in charge of his master's household. Then Joseph is wrongly accused, thrown into jail, and his character still shines. Now he gets put in charge of all the other inmates. 2 years after he interprets the dreams of a couple of these guys who got out, specifically the Pharaoh's cupbearer, he remembers when Pharaoh has a dream. They get Joseph, he comes, he interprets the dream, and now he's what, 20, 21 years old, something like that? He is still called a youth at that point, and he's second in the kingdom, second only to Pharaoh. That's a youth. How about David? David was keeping his father's sheep as a youth, 16 years old. In 1 Samuel 17, this is the chapter when he encounters Goliath, what is the reasoning David uses saying is, I don't want your armor, I'm going to go face Goliath with what I have? He says, because as a youth, as this young man, I'm watching the sheep, the lion and the bear came, and I took on the lion and the bear. What's Goliath? He had learned as a youth to trust God in the difficult situations of life. And that's exactly what he told Saul. He was, in fact, David was upset that the army of Israel was letting this uncircumcised Philistine, that's how he described him, taunt them. So he told King Saul, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And by the way, when he talks about deliverance, David went after the lion and the bear. He wasn't just defensive action. He was aggressive because the lion, the bear, was taking the sheep. David goes out in the field and here's Goliath, 9 feet tall. He's a big guy. David's described this point still being ruddy. He probably had not hit full growth yet. And Goliath is taunting him, and here's what David says. And listen to his trust in the Lord in this statement. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And David did exactly that, didn't he? His trust wasn't in his ability, his trust was in God. Are we training our youths to have that kind of trust in God? Daniel and his three friends, they're all youths. They're taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar, 605 BC. All of them stepped out in faith to do what they knew the Lord wanted and trusting him for the result. The result, they became the wisest of this whole group that's being trained, and they end up in important officials in Nebuchadnezzar's administration. That prepared them for standing firm when later trials, whether the fiery furnace for the three of them or the lion's den for Daniel, that came later. There was no question in their mind. I learned to trust God back then. I trust him now. He'll take care of me. And that's how they learned it. They learned it as youth. They didn't have to wait till they're old. Youth, they learned it. And so while parents of youth do need to be protective in many respects, as I already know, they also need to teach their teens to stand firm for God despite the dangers they may face. If we want them to grow up to be like these great heroes of faith of old, then we need to help them walk with God, grounded in their own faith in him. Somewhere it's got to become first-hand faith, not second-hand faith. They do it because they believe it, not because mom and dad believe it. It's your responsibility to challenge them and enable them to take on increasing responsibilities by which they learn to walk with God. Youth are capable of doing so many more difficult things than most adults think are possible. They are no longer children, but they need your help in making the transition to become adults. That's the period they're in. They're becoming adults. It is one reason we do this Young Men's Challenge and Young Women's Challenge. We are telling them, we are expecting this from you. We expect more than probably your school does or the government does or anybody else. We expect what God expects from you. You're transitioning. We're going to be there to help you, encourage you, but we expect you to fulfill your responsibilities as they come upon you. Now, perhaps the greatest tragedy, the one that occurs way too often in society and too often among Christians, is when these two extremes get together. It's like, but they seem they're opposite. Yeah, but they get together. Youth are given the freedom to make choices as he or she desires, and then they're protected from the consequences of their decisions. That's terrible. That teaches them to be irresponsible and selfish. Now, that can be something simple as you let them waste their time, they neglect their chores, and then you still let them do whatever they wanted to do, even though they haven't fulfilled their responsibilities. Okay? You let them do what they want, and then there's no consequence. It can become serious when they break the law and they get arrested, and you bail them out and hire a lawyer, so they're off the hook. There's a problem there. I'm going to admit, my father had a saying that we learned, you know, like that tall. If you're smart enough to get in trouble, you're smart enough to get out of it. And he made it clear because so many of his peers' children were in jail. He said, if you end up in jail, I'll come visit you. But that's it. Like, thanks, Dad. And Mom would say, look, if it wasn't your fault, we'll find out and we'll help you if it wasn't your fault. But if it's your fault, you're in trouble. Okay, you get the idea? Okay? There's a responsibility that goes with choices. But we remove so many of those. We can't do that. Giving freedom without responsibility is a sure way to destroy your youth and make them burdens on society instead of those who are going to help. Proverbs warns that parents that will not discipline their children hate them. We saw that a couple of weeks ago, Proverbs 13:24 and 19:19. That is strong. That's a very strong statement. How much more worse is it when the parent now interferes from the chastening of God? That's terrible hatred. And yet, I have seen parents do exactly that. Do you realize that negative consequences, let me go back one, negative consequences is the teacher of last resort, is the teacher of the naive, the proud, and the sinful. Do not remove the lessons of this teacher of last resort. And let's face it, all of us have learned lessons from this teacher. And boy, did we learn them. It sticks with you. Don't remove the lessons of the teacher. Now, what's the reason for such poor parenting and the tragic results at the expense of our youth? Well, primarily, it's going to come back down to purpose and philosophy. Those who do not understand their own purpose in life can't help their children find their purpose, can they? Those who refuse to follow the biblical principles in their own life are not going to be able to help their children follow those principles in their lives. Those who think themselves to be wiser than God are going to prove their own foolishness at their children's expense. And those who will not overcome their innate selfishness to love their children and seek their good are going to ensure their children's suffering. Now, I've commented in the previous sermons on Ephesians 6:4. It's a command to us parents. Bring up your children in the discipline, the instruction of the Lord. The sermon on Proverbs on parenting was expressly to make that point. We are to raise our children to be wise. Now, I want to expand on how you make that work in these teen years and adolescence. Now, I've mentioned before, you cannot ensure your children are going to become genuine Christians. That's up to God, okay? That's His work. But you do prepare the way for it, right? We are responsible to teach them all about God, His character, what He's done, and His commandments, Deuteronomy 6:4 through 7. We're to be diligent doing that. We're to train them to keep those commandments. You also can ensure that you are the godly example they can follow, that they should be able to follow in your footsteps. And these figure directly into your purpose and goals at this stage of parenting. Now, since the goal is to produce a wise adult, you need to be one yourself. In fact, if you give wise words and you refuse to follow them yourself, your teen's going to recognize you're a hypocrite and they're not going to listen to you. They're just going to shut you off. I could care less. He's not even honest. But that doesn't mean you have to live a perfect life or have lived a perfect life. I have seen this trap happen too often. I run into parents, they don't think they can correct their children, even with extreme things like drug abuse and premarital sex, because, I did the same thing at their age. No. If anything, the regrets you have for your past sins should be the strongest warning possible to your own children. Don't go and do what I did. I was wrong. And here's all the terrible ramifications of it. Use that as a warning. It is the fool that despises wisdom and instruction and hates knowledge and is right in its own eyes and mocks at sin and is arrogant, rejects a father's discipline, and does not listen to rebuke. Do not let your children be fools. Those are all from Proverbs. The wise do the opposite. They are gladly hear and heed reproof, knowing that in doing so, they are acquiring the understanding for life. Proverbs 15:32 and 25:12. Don't excuse their behavior, your teens, saying, I did the same thing their age. Rebuke them and warn them. Why? Well, maybe it's true. You overcame it. That's great. Don't assume your children are. They may not. The things you were able to overcome may overwhelm them, and they're going to sink and drown. Not only that, don't presume on God withholding his judgment that long. Do you remember the parable Jesus told in Luke? Oh, actually, it wasn't a parable. He was just pointing out a fact. Luke 13:4, the Tower of Siloam fell and killed a bunch of people. And Jesus used that and pointed out you too need to repent lest this come upon you. Do not assume that God's going to allow your child a long enough life to get there. Warn them before. And finally, I hope you love your children enough to want them to do better than you. I certainly want my children to do better than me. I hope they stand on my shoulders and far surpass me in every single way. There can't be a greater joy for a parent than that. Let's just say it's the better part of the extreme of when Jonathan was about 12 or 13. He liked to arm wrestle me. And when he was getting about 13 or 14, he could beat me. He just didn't know he could beat me. And I remember he almost beat me, but I knew the technique, got him down. And I said, Jonathan, you know what's going to happen the day you beat me? No, what, Dad? I said, I'm put my arm around you and say, that's my boy. That's what I want. I want them to succeed me and go far surpass me. Do you love your children that much that they become better than you? Well, at the same time, we need to be careful falling to a different trap, and that's thinking that you have to have it all together to either correct or give wisdom to teens. That mindset is going to force you either to become a hypocrite or neglect their training. All you need to do to correct your teens is be an honest and humble adult. That's it. Be honest with them and be humble with them. Do you realize some of the best lessons you're going to teach them are from your own example and your struggle to overcome your own failures, your own sin, and encourage them to be part of that with you? You will teach them tremendous things. That's where they live. They recognize they don't have it all together, and they want someone to show them the way. Show them the way by your own example. Be honest with them. Be humble with them. And then both of you end up walking together. Wisdom and encouragement can flow both directions. Now, since the goal is to raise a wise adult, then your parenting practice must reflect this continued pursuit of that goal. And I cannot stress enough the importance of keeping the focus on your purpose. A couple of weeks ago, I said that in raising your children, you're going to have to decide whether you're going to do it according to God's wisdom or the world's wisdom. If your goal for your children is worldly success, things like material wealth, fame, power, pleasure, then you're going to raise them that way. If your goal is to raise them in godly wisdom, you're going for different goals, because godly goals are different. It's contentment and being humble and being meek and being a servant. The goal of worldly wisdom is man's glory and fulfilling human desire. The goal of godly wisdom is God's glory in fulfilling His will. Now, a friend of mine, Warren Lamb, and some of you might remember Warren, he and his family were here for some years, he read my sermon and he sent me this very insightful comment. I want to read it to you. He says, "I think for most non-Christians, and many Christians, the goal they have for their children is to just make sure they can fit in or be able to comfortably live in today's society, be good citizens, know how to handle situations, work with everyone, do well, and, well, be recognized by the world for it, and just be nice. Most don't care much about wealth, fame, and power for their children. The parents care about making sure their kids can live as stress-free in the culture today as possible. That would be considered their blessing, their teaching. Of course, that necessitates compromise of godly values, character, and wisdom." He says, "Most unfortunate, I've seen it in my own extended family as well as friends." Warren's insight is tragically true, and so it makes even stronger this emphasis. You must keep the proper focus. What is your purpose? What is your goal? Will you raise them by to be wise by God's standards or the world's standards? Raising godly kids takes a lot of effort. It is not for the faint of heart. And even more so as our society continues its slide into ungodliness. And actually, I think we're getting to the point where we're nearly free fall. You will have conflicts if you strive to raise them to be godly. You will have conflicts with them. Why? When they were born, what did they come in the world as? Sinners. Okay? And there's still that bent. You're going to have conflict with them. That's not what they want. So what? We're going to do what God wants. We're going to learn to do it God's way. You're going to have very challenging conversations with your teens. Why? Because there is a point in their life they must, and I repeat this, they must come to grips that it's their faith, their belief. And they are being influenced from all sorts of areas, entertainment, movies, television, radio, the music they listen to, the stuff they're watching on the computer, YouTube, Facebook, you name it. They've got all this information flowing into them that's challenging them on the principles that you've been teaching them. Somewhere they've got to learn to apply the principles in their own life. Is it because they believe it and they know it's true? Or just because mom and dad said so? You're going to have challenging questions as they learn to grapple with the reasoning. Don't shy away from that. Take the time. I have found it took more time as my kids were in their teens and late teens than it is when they were young, because we're working through all these things. I don't know how many times at the dinner table, especially Jonathan, because Jonathan has this quest to figure things out, and he likes to play devil's advocate, which isn't a good thing to do with dad. So the rest of the family would get up and leave, and we'd still be there an hour and a half, I'm not exaggerating, still talking about things. But that's what was necessary. Are you willing to sacrifice of yourself to give them that? They're going to be challenged. Help them work through those challenges. You're also going to have conflicts with the world because it's completely opposite of what it's now pushing, even in American society. You're also going to have conflicts with other Christians. Now, that's the tragedy, but it's the reality, because there's a lot of professing Christians. They're not in the same place in the walk of the Lord as you. Now, one part of this is good. If they are farther along in their walk, you want them to challenge you on what you're doing, that you can walk better with the Lord and more intimately and more carefully. But you're also going to have those who are going to challenge what you're doing, and they're going to be very frustrating to you because all they're doing is really defending their own immaturity and their continued bent to sin themselves. And they want to make you out like you're the ones who got the problem. Our goal is to raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Not in my way, your way, or somebody else's way. It's the Lord's way is what we're after. Are you pushing for that? Is that your goal? Now that brings you back to the point again. What's your purpose? What's your goal? What do you want your children to be like when they are grown? Now that means you're starting this when they're little, right? You don't wait till they're 16 to decide, now we're going to start. If you're at 16 and now starting, yeah, you can do it. But it means your life now is completely wrapped up with them, and they are glued to your side like a Siamese twin, and they're not getting away. It's the only way you're going to handle that when it gets that bad. But you start when they're young and training them. This is the way we're going. This is the Lord's way. I want you to be a responsible adult who is wise and can stand on your own convictions, even when the whole world turns against you. I read a book I got at the Shepherd's Conference. It was by a gal named Faith Cook called Lady Jane Grey, 9-Day Queen of England. And I've always found her a fascinating character, but this lady has done a lot more research. And it's a wonderful book, and she is a fantastic role model for all youth, especially girls, since because of her position. Now, Lady Jane Grey was born in the early 1500s, actually getting toward the mid-1500s. Incredible what she understood. She knew seven languages. She corresponded with the major reformers of that period. And then she was in a difficult position. She was forced into becoming Queen of England, and her older sister, Mary, didn't like that. Mary came down with an army, defeated those who were supposed to defend her, and she was taken to the Tower of London. What do you do with her? Mary didn't really want to kill her, but there was a lot of pressure that it had to be that way. So there was an option given to her. If you convert to Catholicism, you can live. If you continue to believe what you have been pushing, that you've gotten from the reformers, you must die. She is 16 years old when this is put upon her. Now, her goal at that point really was she just as soon died. She was ready. She had worked through everything. But the Queen Mary's personal chaplain, a fellow named Dr. Feckenham, and he actually was a leading Roman Catholic apologist of that period, forced her into a debate. You're 16. This is the leading Catholic apologist. How are you going to fare? She not only held her own, at the end of it, Dr. Feckenham confessed that despite all of his learning, it would have been more appropriate that day they had switched places, and she had been the teacher and he had been the disciple. At 16, the very next day, she was led out, and she died under the headsman's axe, bearing witness that she died as a true Christian woman, saying, she only looked to be saved by no other means but only the mercy of God and the blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. Could your 16-year-old do that? Do you have a goal that they could do that? If your goal's not there, they're not going to accomplish it. This woman was incredible. Get the book, read it, use it as encouragement. Oh, that kind of faith, that sign of strong conviction would be in all our children. So by the time they are in their mid-teens, they likewise can stand firm against all the pressures against them, and they are huge in the schools. If you're homeschooling or you got them in a Christian school, at some point they're going to be in a college. And don't think if you send them to a Christian college, they're going to escape the pressures. They're there too. Their friends, their peers are going to put them in pressure. Can they stand alone? Can you help them so that they become the kind of person who is going to influence others instead of being influenced by them? There's your goal. Well, how then do you transition from childhood to become wise and responsible adults? Prayer, hard work, patience, and diligence. Prayer because ultimately their lives are in God's hands. You better spend a lot of time on your knees. Hard work because it takes that to fulfill the responsibilities God has placed upon you. That's what you're trying to fulfill there. Patience, because kids never learn as fast as you'd like them to. And diligence, because there's always going to be another lesson to teach them, or a lesson you thought you taught them earlier that you're going to have to go back and repeat. So there's diligence that must be into this as well. And there is no magical age when you're done with all your parenting responsibilities. Your children learn over time as they become a youth and then become a young adult. And as they take on more responsibilities, they become more independent of you, eventually setting up their own household. But even then, there are still things you're going to teach them as their most trusted and close advisor. At least that's the relationship you should be desiring to have with your adult children. The age, the rate in which your children mature is going to vary by family and by individual child. Let me explain this in very practical terms using a funnel illustration I picked up from Growing Families International, the parenting class I've taught for many years. Now, the width of the funnel illustrates increasing freedom and responsibility. They go hand in hand. When your children are very young, the world is very restricted. They have very few responsibilities, right? They start out, they're confined to the crib or the playpen because you can't trust them. Or as we said, when Jonathan was that age and he was crawling around so many cabinets, so little time, I couldn't trust him. He was going to get into something. He wasn't trained yet. We were working on it. As you teach them to obey the first time right away, the walls come down. Our boys went from the crib to playing on an area rug. Yes, we put an area rug out and said, you have to stay on the rug. And they did. They also had sit time. They'd sit in a chair, they'd get a book, and they had to sit there for so long with just a book. That was training them so they could handle things like doctor's offices and sitting in church. We were training them. As they increased in their obedience there, their world expanded. It expanded greatly. They got their own room. They got the house. They got the backyard. Continued expansion as we could trust them. The backyard meant, because we didn't have a fence up at that time, is no going around to the front where you're going to get run over by a car. We had to be able to trust them. And then as they continued that, they could go play at their friends' houses. Now that expanded freedom also meant the next step of parenting had to be taking place. I had to train their heart. It's one thing for them to be obedient around you, but will they do the same thing when they're around other people? That's the question. We taught them the moral reasons we did or did not do things and trained them to think for themselves in applying the moral principles. We trained their hearts. And as their hearts were trained, their world expanded more to match the responsibilities they were able to take on for themselves. They could ride their bikes to go see their friends in the neighborhood. They could participate in sleepovers because we knew they would be good over there. And we would ask the parents later, how were our children? A lot of you remember that. We would always be asking that question. How did they do when they weren't in our with us? Because we wanted to be able to keep training their hearts. As the boys entered their teens, we gave them more responsibilities. They became more, and we became more diligent to teach them life skills. The things they're going to need to know in order to make it on their own when they're out of the house. Riding a bike meant learning how to repair a bike. The variety of household chores increased. They learned to clean everything. They learned to do their own laundry. They learned to cook. They learned to make minor household repairs. They started small businesses so they could learn how to handle money. Eventually, we had to teach them to drive a car. But learning to drive a car meant you need to learn how to repair a car, fix a car, take the responsibilities of its maintenance. And in each of these areas, freedom and responsibility were tied together. Sometimes it was responsibility first and then freedom. Sometimes it's the other way around, and to test if they could handle it, we would give them freedom to see how they do with it. Think questions like, who could be their friends? Where could they go? How late can you stay out? How are you using your money? If they couldn't handle it, we went back down the funnel. More restrictions came back until they could handle it. And we keep pushing them. More responsibilities, more freedom. You can't handle it? We go back down. As our boys became young men, the restrictions of childhood were steadily removed until all that was left were, essentially, it's the common courtesies of sharing a household. They needed to tell us where they're going, when they plan to be back. That's simply a safety issue. It's a courtesy to those you live with. And they would tell us where they were going. They'd tell us where they'd be home for dinner. They still had household chores. They're still part of the house, so they had to carry out their own chores and help out with the family work. And, of course, we talked about everything. In my household, often from the theological perspective, and we still do. The point is simply this. You transition your sons and your daughters from childhood into pre-adolescence, then into adolescence, and then into youth, and finally adulthood by moving up and down the funnel of responsibility and freedom. Do not keep them so restricted they do not learn what they need to know and have the skills necessary to be a functioning independent adult. And neither allow them so much freedom that you have set them up to fail. This is why this period of parenting can be difficult. because you're always adjusting freedom and responsibility as they learn to handle these things, and yet always pushing them upward. You got to handle more. You got to handle more. You be the responsible parent who trains your children to become mature and become responsible adults themselves. Proverbs 8:32 says, "Now therefore, O sons, listen to me, for blessed are they who keep my ways." Proverbs 23:4 is our goal. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who begets a wise son will be glad in him. That is what I'd like for all of you. Rejoice and be glad in your adult children.